WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Steve Earle is a singer, songwriter, guitarist who has made a comeback after kicking addictions to heroin and crack and serving several months in jail on possession charges in 1994. He has a new CD called El Corazon. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded with him last year. Steve Earle's first album, released in 1986, positioned him within country music's new traditionalism. It went to number one on the country charts and was later described in Newsweek as helping to galvanize Nashville out of its post-Rube and cowboy cheeseball slump. Since beginning his comeback a couple of years ago, he's had three CDs, Train A-Coming, I Feel All Right, and his new one. Let's start with a track from that new CD, El Corazon. This is his song, Telephone Road.
My brother Jim and my other brother Jack went off down to Houston and never come back. Mama wasn't gonna let her baby go yet, but there ain't nobody hiring back in Lafayette. Working all week for a Texaco check. Sun beating down on the back of my neck. I try to save my money, but Jimmy says no. Says he got a little honey on Telephone Road. Come on, come on, come on, let's go. It's in Louisiana, your mama won't know. Come on, come on, come on, let's go. Everybody's rocking on Telephone Road.
Steve Earle from his new CD. When I spoke with him last year, I read a paragraph he wrote in 1995 that he used on a liner note. He wrote, "When I was locked up, I was getting ready to go off on this boy who stole my radio. My partner Paul asked me where I was going. I said, to get my radio and then to go to the hole for a little while. He looked at me like I look at my 13-year-old sometimes and said, no, you ain't. You're going to sit your little white ass down and do your little time, and then you're going to get out of here and make a nice record. So I made two." I asked Steve Earle what that paragraph was about.
Just about exactly what it says.
Who is Paul?
A friend of mine that I knew from the street, and I got into jail, and he was there. And he was one of a couple of people that I hung out with when I was locked up that I knew. Two of them I knew from the outside. One of them was a guy I met in there. But one of the safest ways to go in an institution is to belong to as small a clique as possible, because they'll put 50 men in one cell, and so when stuff happens, it happens a lot faster than the guards can do anything about it. So it's a really potentially volatile environment. If you belong to a big clique of people, you know, 10 guys, 20 guys, you can't control their actions, and they may do something, and because to make somebody else mad, and that person that they've irritated may not have access to them, and then may go off on you in the recreation area or in the gym or someplace else where the situation is not so controlled. So I sort of stuck in. We had one little corner of this 50-man cell that we sort of stayed in, and except to go and take showers and stuff. And it was just people that I knew, and they did take care of me because I was very sick when I got to jail. I was withdrawing from methadone and cocaine, and I was extremely ill. And Paul got me. I had an upper bunk, and by the third or fourth day, I couldn't even get in my bunk by myself. And Paul helped me get up there, and he also made sure that I secured a bottom bunk when the upper bunk became totally unworkable. He'd been there for about a year and a half when I got there, and never had been to trial. And he's still there, as far as I know.
How long were you in this prison?
I was in 60 days. I was doing a year. I was doing 11 months and 29 days. After much begging and pleading from my lawyer and 30 days in treatment, they finally decided to probate the rest of my sentence.
Now, you grew up in San Antonio in a pretty middle-class family, right? Your father was an air traffic controller.
Yeah, I was very middle-class. we moved a lot. We were renters, so we lived all over the San Antonio area. I grew up, what I really call home is a town called Schertz that's right outside of San Antonio, and it's sort of been engulfed by San Antonio now, but it was about 30 miles outside the city limits when I was growing up there. Randolph Air Force Base is there. There's about 5 Air Force bases in San Antonio, which are the major industry, no matter what anybody thinks.
You dropped out of high school in 1971 and really wanted to, you know, write songs and perform. You started hanging out with the songwriter Townes Van Zandt. Why him? What excited you about him? Or was he one of the few songwriters that you actually had access to?
Well, he was one of the few songwriters. I mean, there were a lot of songwriters in Texas that I could have access to. Actually, it was a pretty damn good place to be a songwriter when I first started writing. I mean, there was Townes and Jerry Jeff and Steve Fromholz, and who I saw the other night for the first time in years. There was a lot going on in Austin, and of course, naturally, everybody was telling me, "Hey, this is you don't need to go to New York or L.A. or Nashville because we got, you know, the music business is coming to Austin. This is going to be the next music industry center." Even at 19 years old, I knew that wasn't true. Austin's the weather's too good, the girls are too pretty, and the dope's too cheap, and you can't get anything done in a place like that. So I came to Nashville.
Well, let's hear a song that you wrote that Travis Tritt recently had a hit of, and you recorded this on your next-to-last album, Steve Earle, Train A-Comin'. This is called Sometimes She Forgets. When did you write this?
Yeah, go ahead. It's an old song. It's an old song. It was written during the period when I was getting up and going to the office and writing songs every day, and I wrote what I thought were a lot of really commercial songs, and they told me that they were too country, so none of them ever got recorded until this one did last year.
I like the song a lot. What do you think of it now?
I'm real proud of it. It's always been one of my favorite songs I've ever written. The songs that survived to make it on to Train A-Comin' were the older songs of mine that I seemed to always dust off when I went out and did a solo acoustic tour. That was the main criteria.
Oh, okay. Well, this is Steve Earle.
If you see her out tonight, she tells you it's just the lights that bring her here and not her loneliness. That's what she says, but sometimes she won't guess. If she tells you she don't need a man, she's had all the comfort she can stand. You'd best believe every word she says. But don't give up, cause sometimes she forgets.
Steve Earle from his previous record called Train A-Comin'. Now, you've said you first did heroin when you were 13. How did you do it? How did you get it?
Well, it's San Antonio, Texas, during the Vietnam War. It was 150 miles from the border, so there's a constant supply of real strong, real cheap brown heroin, and then the Vietnam War going on. So there was lots of dope, and it was very, very cheap. Dope was cheaper than alcohol in the city I grew up in.
Who turned you
much
on?
Much cheaper. It's a lot of people at school, my uncle, and who also gave me my first guitar, so that was sort of a mixed deal. But
did your father know?
My father, I don't think they knew the extent of my drug habit. My music always seemed to intervene enough. Like, I moved to Nashville, and the heroin up here sucked, so I sort of stopped doing it. And it was... until I got to where I could afford it, and started traveling around other cities where there were better drugs, and I slowly drifted back into doing it again. When I stopped doing heroin, I replaced it with other drugs, but it my parents they were aware. It became an issue in around the house a few times, but I was pretty good. I was an addict. Addicts are good at getting over, and I managed to convince the psychiatrist I was sent to that I was cured, and he pronounced me cured, and that was the end of it as far as my family was concerned.
Did you keep your habit hidden from people in the record company, or do you think that they knew?
They knew. I was nowhere near as good as hiding it as I should have been in retrospect. I was sort of, I think I thought I was invisible. And that got worse as my habit became worse. I think as long as I was performing, as I was making shows, which I did to the very, very last, as long as I was making shows and making records, there were people that just sort of turned their back on it. It made them uncomfortable, but they turned their back on it. There were other people that I think actually thought it was kind of cool, as long as it wasn't them. And I probably fed off that to a certain extent. It's just one of those deals. It's not that it's really your tendency when you're in active addiction is to think that you're special. The way I looking back at it now, I was doing the same thing that all addicts do. It's called permission to use. And I didn't need a reason to take drugs. I was an addict. I could always tell you one if you asked me, but I didn't really need a reason. But just being an addict was reason enough.
At the periods when you were most addicted, were you able to perform? Were you able to write? Was there music in your head? I mean, had music remained a part of your world?
No, it got to the point where it wasn't at all. The last 2 years especially, I didn't. I hung out in South Nashville for a lot of reasons. It's where the drugs were, but I could have beeped people and then have bought me drugs. And one time I did it that way. I didn't have to hang out there. One of the reasons I hung out there is black people do not listen to my music, and so I was fairly anonymous there. And people just left me alone as long as I had money to pay for drugs. And it's not... I got to a point that it was a full-time job just to get up in the morning and get my hands on enough money to support my habit. Whether I had money or not, I still had to go get it, and I used it up at such a furious rate that I was always a little bit ahead of my royalty checks. I didn't have to do some of the things other people have to do, but I would have. You know, no doubt in my mind, at the bottom had just fallen out, I couldn't get any more money, I would have been stealing stuff to support my habit. It was just a matter of time.
So the habit just drove music out of your head?
It drove it out of my life. There wasn't any time. I didn't even have a guitar. I'd traded them all for dope in the middle of the night or pawned them. I lost a lot of nice guitars. But it really was, even if I'd had a guitar, I wouldn't have had time to play it. I woke up in the morning and I was on the trail from the time I woke up until I went to sleep, which was usually 3 or 4 days later.
Did the degradation aspect of it ever get to you? Of being so enslaved to the habit, and having lost something that was so special for you, your music.
Yeah, I mean, it. I know when I started to die, and that was when it got to the point that I couldn't write anymore, and I knew I was dying, but I just didn't think that there was anything that I could do about it.
Now, when you were in prison, you ended up in rehab during the prison stay. So you were addicted when you got into prison. Were you able to kick during that rehab stay?
Well, I went to a hospital. They finally realized that they didn't want to be responsible for me at age. I was 39, and I wasn't in the best physical condition. And my blood pressure got pretty high, which is a withdrawal symptom, and they decided they didn't want to be responsible for me being in the Metro jail anymore. So my lawyer worked it out for me to go to into treatment. I was still an inmate, but I went to Lincoln Regional Hospital, which is down in Fayetteville, Tennessee, and I did my medical detox there, and that means that they basically give you medication to control your blood pressure and monitor you. And the food was a lot better there than it was in jail. It was just a matter of once I got there, I don't know what happened, but something... I guess the fog cleared because I actually had been physically restrained from taking drugs for several weeks, and that hadn't happened to me in years. I probably wouldn't have gotten clean if I hadn't gotten locked up. I know I wouldn't have. I would have just died.
My guest is Steve Earle. He has a new CD called El Corazon. We'll hear more of our 1996 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1996 interview with Steve Earle. When did music start coming back into your head?
As soon as I got to Buffalo Valley and in jail, there aren't any guitars.
The treatment center.
Yeah, there aren't any guitars in jail. That's just in the movies. But in Buffalo Valley, I was allowed to have a guitar an hour a day. And I wrote Goodbye, which is on Train to Come. It was the first thing I'd written in 4 years. And I wrote Hardcore Troubadour, which is actually a melody that I'd started 3 or 4 years before. But I wrote all the lyrics and treatment.
Why don't we hear Hardcore Troubadour? It's the second track on your new CD.
Girl, don't bother and lock your door. It's out there hollering, darling, don't you love me no more. You always let him in before, now didn't you? He's just singing the same old song that he always sang before. He's the last of the hardcore troubadours. Just a somebody switch now, wouldn't you? You gonna make love on your satin sheets, wake up on your living room floor. He's the last of the hardcore troubadours. And now he's the last of the young night do right. Send the need to win the daylight. He's the last of the hardcore troubadours.
That's Steve Earle from his new CD, I Feel All Right. How do you think your voice changed after a long period of not singing and after a long period of doing drugs, which can be very hard on the voice? I mean, I think your voice sounds really great and really strong, and I'll confess I'm really surprised at how strong it sounds.
Well, my voice got a rest. One thing about sitting around, you know, like shooting dope, smoking crack for a few years, I wasn't singing. And I really had gotten to the point that I toured so much. And heroin's very hard on your voice. Actively using and singing, heroin relaxes your vocal cords. You could always tell when I was high because my voice would drop about an octave. And you go out and try to sing, you try to bring, you try to hit high notes and bring your vocal cords up to tension, and there's a certain amount of thickening that happens. And that had happened to me. Plus, I had a traumatic injury to my vocal cords. I was arrested for assaulting a police officer in Dallas. I assaulted his nightstick with my neck, is what I did, and it just got into a big thing. They tried to send me to the penitentiary for that, and that was one situation where I was absolutely innocent. But one of my vocal cords bled really badly. So there's a big difference between my voice if you listen to, like, Exit Zero and Copperhead Road. It became a lot gravel. There's a lot more gravel in it from that point on. And that's still there. But I got a rest. And I think I'm singing the best on this record. And these are all track vocals on this record. Every vocal on I Feel All Right is the straight track, you know, vocal performance. There aren't any overdubs on it.
I've spoken to some performers who are really surprised at what it feels like to perform when they're straight because they'd never really experienced it before.
Yeah.
Is that the position you're in? Is it a different experience to perform straight?
No, it's basically that. I mean, I didn't think that I went out and performed. I would have told you that I'd never performed when I was high, but I obviously had to at the end because if I hadn't been high, I would have been sick.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I perform sick a lot. You know, that ended up happening. Drug dealers aren't necessarily dependable people. I think I'm a better performer than I've ever been. I'm definitely a better writer than I've ever been. I'm really, really proud of this record. The band right now is smoking. This whole tour has been a lot of fun, and I was very relieved to find out that I genuinely enjoy my job, because it had gotten sort of miserable for me, because everything's miserable for a junkie.
Mm-hmm.
You get to the point, it's really nice to go out on the road and not wake up sick in the morning and not have to worry about where I'm going to get dope in a town I've never been to before. And it's put a lot of the fun back in it for me. And so I'm back to some sort of midlife crisis that's taking place in a bus, but I'm really, really enjoying being out there.
What's the midlife crisis about?
Well, it's just, you know, I'm 41 years old, and I actually am probably more roadworthy than I was when I was 31.
But you don't want to be on the road that much, or?
No, I love being on the road. That's the whole point. I feel like maybe I'm not supposed to.
Oh, I see.
Like
okay.
it as much as I do now. It's not a, you know, it's like a, it's buses are rolling locker rooms. It really gets to you after a while. It's a bunch of people living at fairly close quarters. We had our air conditioner break down in the bus one time in 87. We were going across the desert, and we made a little videotape we called Das Bus because it got down to everybody sitting around in their underwear playing cards, you know, and because the air conditioning did not work. And in 1990, which was the last full-blown tour that I did, I was thinking at the end of it, boy, I guess I'm just burnt out and I'm tired of doing this. And the truth of the matter, all I was tired of was trying to deal with my drug habit and perform. I'm having more fun making records than I ever have, and more fun than I've had touring in a long, long time.
Steve Earle recorded last year. He'll tour Europe in November and December. Earle has a new CD called El Corazon. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.